You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and you are listening to the Orthodox Nationalist here on Radio Albion. Today's date is the 24th of March, 2024. Before I get into the topic, I've received a spate of very generous donations recently. And, of course, you know who you are, and I want to publicly thank you for this. You know I depend in no small extent on donations from my listeners, from my readers. And I have some generous friends. Don't forget about my Patreon page, which is also another big part of this, where I'm constantly uploading papers on all manner of topics. But of course, always centering them around the basic structure of the philosophy of history I've put out over the last 25 years. And I'm going to do that again today, a topic that I've been dealing with for many, many years. Partially because of what I've been reading, but we're going to talk about Renaissance Florence, and of course, you can't mention Renaissance Florence without the Medicis and without the sin of usury. I'm reading Michael Hoffman's book on the Renaissance papacy, now for the second time. Catherine Fletcher's book on Alessandro de' Medici. Raymond DeRuver. Also, The Rise and Decline of the Medici Bank. And a disappointing book by John Noonan back in the 50s called The Scholastic Analysis of Usury. That one I got directly from E. Michael Jones's Barron Medal. And I say it's disappointing only because it's, to some extent, it mischaracterizes the issue, it mischaracterizes the debate, and it mischaracterizes the position of churches both East and West on, in fact, what usury is. I taught a class in the Renaissance years ago at Mount St. Mary's University, and it's significant for everything that we do here, primarily because it's the gateway to modernity. This is when the Middle Ages was dissolving. It was dissolving due to the Black Death. It was dissolving because of the Hundred Years' War and the papacy at Avignon. The unity of Western Christendom was now, both intellectual and theological, was falling apart. It's unfortunate that this is precisely the time when there was no more Byzantine Empire, and what arose in the Fanar-dominated Istanbul was a church based almost entirely on simony, losing its, as Russia ended up being the standard bearer. The Renaissance is essentially the bread and circuses of the early modern era. What came out of the Black Death was labor rebellion, Tiampi revolt, of course, debt, and the institutionalization of plutocracy. This broke the back of the Middle Ages. Florence, you know, I've dealt with Venice before, several times before. In fact, I have a paper coming out on this. Now we're dealing with the oligarchy of Florence. And it's very convenient to start with the Ciampi Revolt in 1378. It was very briefly revolted against the plutocracy. Now, the Medici's came, the Medici Bank was established at the end of the Middle Ages, but they had competition. The Albizzi family, for example, in fact, they were the rivals of the Medici clan. And they ruled really until 1434. But when I talk about the Medici, we're really talking about Cosimo and his successors. Because this was the direct rule of a bank over an extremely significant city. The Medici family ruled through a functional constitution. And he rules, of course, more importantly, banks rule from behind the scenes. They can't openly proclaim the fact that they rule you directly. And bringing new immigrants into the city from elsewhere was part of his patronage system. But Florence, at its height, was governed by the Council of the Signoria. And every few months, the head of it was chosen by lot. And I think it's humorous that in order to be chosen for this, you can't have ever declared bankruptcy. You have to have fully sound finances. You have to be a member of one of Florence's seven guilds, including two cloth guilds, which the Chiappi was one. And of course, this lottery, I probably don't have to say this, but it's predetermined. The roster of names, of course, gets updated every once in a while. And one of the more interesting aspects of this is in order to be able to hold office in oligarchic Florence, you have to have come from a family that had previously held office. So this chaos is one of the things that not only, led to the Chiappi Rebellion, the revolt, but also is one of the things that exhausted the population. Florence was, other than a banking center, it was a banking center because it was the center of the cloth trade. We'll get to that in a minute. In fact, probably the majority of labor in the city-state of Florence was involved in this industry. They got into silk as well. None of this really, we need to remember the Byzantine Empire was gone at this point, either at the very verge of destruction or completely gone. And that empowered North Italy, especially the Venetians, Genoa, to expand their commercial empire. You get to the point where any order was better than what was going on. And once the Medici began expanding, consolidating its operations, their behind-the-scenes rule became one of the most sophisticated and really, inaccessible to the broader population. Places like the Bardi House, the Peruzzi House. Giovanni de' Medici founded this at the very end of the 14th century. Having been trained essentially in the banking houses in Rome, but given the history of the banking cults in Florence, it was the place to go. In this age, capitalism was a financial matter. It's tightly connected with the civilization of the sea. If you remember, I did the whole thing on the Venetian ritual of the marriage of the city to the sea. And I got into in great detail the cult ritual and the symbols used in this marriage. Of course, Florence was a bit of a different story. The Medici clan will eventually take over from these previous houses. But these previous houses also set up the infrastructure that they were able to take over. We would call them today merchant bankers, which means they're automatically involved in manufacturing. They invested heavily in the wool trade starting in the very beginning of the 15th century. In fact, they helped expand it tremendously. They built at least between 1402 and 1410, two or three factories, including in the silk industry. But as you may know, and as you might imagine, this connection between manufacturing and finance capitalism was also a part of the imperial foreign policy of Florence. And the wars in this era became extremely bitter. War was almost a constant here, leading, on the one hand, to the enrichment of those who profited from war, but it also led to a decreased demand for its commercial products. Now, you have to keep in mind, and a few authors have said this, that the accepted vocabulary for economics hadn't come into existence. Economics was not a systematic discipline at all by this time. So modernity, or modernism, was a very practical piecemeal development of the Medici clan. There is no Machiavelli without the city-state of Florence. There's no Thomas Hobbes without the revolutionary actions of banking in general, North Italian banks in particular. Perpetual war means perpetual taxes. And given the only sophistication here was in the banking realm, not so much in the political realm, taxation got very high in Florence, which of course depresses demand. The only thing that they did in response was either lowering the guild's wages, which was nothing but a problem, or debasing the currency. It was an ephemeral domination of the wool market in North Italy, and Medici's got far more involved later on with finance, sort of our own situation of exploitative rent-seeking. And manufacturing slowly fell out of consideration. But they issued bonds. This is how they opened their factory. They got involved with bonds internationally. It's not an accident that this is happening during the Hundred Years' War, one of the things that broke the Middle Ages. But the higher the debt, and remember, several monarchs, especially the French monarch, reneged on his debts. The Spaniards did it as well. The greater the debt, the less valuable that paper was. So their prices fell very quickly. I believe 1460, 1470, the bonds issued early on were maybe at about 15% of their coupon value. It should be noted, and I don't think I've hit this hard enough in the past, but commerce and manufacturing were in decline by the start of the Italian Renaissance. Medici are a symbol for modernity because they amassed their fortune very rapidly, and their decline was equally rapid. And it makes sense because the Florentine economy, the seed of modern capitalism, or capitalism period in the West. Because of this rapid rise and fall, based on the cycle of debt and interest, and the irrational behaviors, both publicly and privately, that it creates. We're talking about macro-level banking. In other words, they were forwarding money to princes. Very, very touchy arena. So, but they would have been in debt regardless. Reneging on debts became a habit of the combatants during the Hundred Years' War. But of course, this has made everything less and less stable. But taxes at some point has to have a ceiling. There's only so far you can go. As even in the early modern world, keep in mind the Italian city-states use mercenaries. They may have had a local militia. Florence was divided into four districts for that purpose. But they used mercenaries, and they were not cheap. This is also an era where military technology was increasing at a huge rate. War was becoming more and more expensive. Florence, or I should say North Italy in general, you know, that comes up during the Fourth Crusade, and it also comes up now in the birth of modernity, let's say the early 16th century. The North Italian states were the dominant economic power in the Western world, and now with the fall of Byzantium, in much of the Eastern world too. You know, the Turkish Empire used often Greek, sometimes Italian, and Jewish moneylenders, bankers, usurers, at the Fanar in Istanbul. They were not involved, we can talk about this in a minute, but they were not involved in record-keeping and day-to-day finance. That was a Greek issue. Italian merchants did very well, largely because of their sophisticated organization. They were not just the main merchants of this era, but they were also the financiers of this era. Exclusive private ownership of property derives from this period of time and the Renaissance that the Medici created, because there was nothing in the Renaissance, the development of the Renaissance in North Italy that was not financed by the Medici bankers. Other than the papacy, it may be argued that the Medici Bank was the most significant institution of this era, not only defining what, you know, we take for granted as capitalism today, but the very modern world. Many of you already know where I'm going. They elected several popes, in fact, a bunch of popes, and they were, get to this in a second, the depositary of the papal chamber, that is to say, a single banker that has the canonical authority to deal with the Roman Church's revenues, no matter where they were from or where they were going. All transactions, in other words. It's not excessive to say that capitalism is inherently a rent-seeking, usurious phenomenon, where the only real mark of success is to what extent you're able to privatize profits and socialize losses. This is the key element in capitalism, even back then. But losses were substantial. Whether it be the wars with places like Pisa, it's a very different sort of a city. The reneging of princely debt, as well as the rise of competition to the north. The Medici's ultimately were heirs to a much older rent-seeking infrastructure of the past. Things like bills of exchange, double-entry bookkeeping, that had been around before. The Medici clan expanded it and used it for their very rapid advance. It's also not an exaggeration to say the fortunes of this bank were tied, just like its originator, tied to the city of Rome itself. It's that position that brought the Medicis to a height of power that few institutions at the time could have enjoyed. Each transaction, they were able to charge a fee for, a commission, so to speak. So it became the papacy's financial agency, including in all forms of international trade, even outside of the European continent. 1406, though, Florence was able to conquer Pisa. When I say it's a very different city, it's a Ghibelline city. They were able to now have an outlet to the sea, which was always a big drawback for Florence. They were always able to come up with a solution to the problem, but they also had to pay fees, they had to pay insurance premiums. And that's the foundation of these initial wars, was to gain this kind of access to the sea without having to pay for anything, although it turns out, given the nature of the war, to be far more expensive than they ever hoped. but any benefits, economic or otherwise, did nothing but strengthen the nature of the plutocracy there in that city. And one of the things that they did, of course, was take over the basic media at the time, because they needed to condemn any of the labor revolts, the camping, and otherwise, as something that was against the spirit of the city, against European values, we might say. And they used this revolt, these barbarous animals, they would, you know, as a way to scare everybody else, people who mattered in their world. Banks control a state. They're well aware that they have no legitimacy. They're well aware that one false move could lead to their deposition. Everything is short-term for a whole bunch of reasons. Despite the fact that economics hadn't really developed as a separate science, they were dimly aware, not well aware, they were dimly aware that nothing they were doing could be sustained over time. The conquest of Pisa, and this comes from a few sources, the history of Florence, as well as E. Michael Jones, a whole bunch of others, some of the people who I cited early on. Conquering Pisa, of course, threatens Milan. So that war continued. 1426, the city was exhausted. The expenses were absolutely ridiculous. A contemporary said it's something like 80,000 gold florins per month, which was an extraordinary sum. Almost 2 million gold florins paid for just this one war. And they, in this period of time, were at war with the exception of 1 or 2 years. This is a perilous condition for the oligarchy. Now, this should be sounding a little familiar to you. The condition of Florence and the condition of the United States and Western Europe is very similar. And to a great extent, you know, wars are fought by mercenaries, both domestic and foreign. You also have to make the point that one of the reasons the empire moved from old Rome to Constantinople was the intense debt and hence rapaciousness of the local capitalists. And in both cases, taxes grew and taxes grew and taxes grew. This kind of capitalism is always tied to imperialism, no matter how large or how small the country is. And we're talking a period roughly from 1380 to 1454, non-stop warfare. 2 million florins in this period of time, maybe more. They also came up with something called the forced loan, or the collective loan. This too was in the millions of gold florins. Of course, what happens when debt grows? Interest becomes more and more expensive, and it gets tacked on to the principal as time goes on. Taxation became absolutely crushing, meaning that power became more and more rarefied, more and more concentrated. The price that Florence had to pay for taking Pisa, this outlet to the sea, was extraordinary. Several authors have noted that the siege of the city was extremely, was horrifying as far as starvation and everything else. Everyone was put under arms. And this created a long-standing hatred between Pisans on the one hand and Florentines on the other. Therefore, from there on in, they would side with anyone who was doing battle with Florence. But what very few people have noted is that because of the nature of these endless and very expensive wars, there has to be an explanation, a propaganda, a story, a narrative. Very much like the Athenians, sea powers tend to do this. And I say sea power either literally or figuratively, piece that was kind of a land power, despite it having an outlet to the sea. But alchemists like Leonardo Bruni, so many others, spoke of the Athenian conception of the just war, because the land powers, the gibbeline powers, were tyrannical, ignorant. Again, this should sound very familiar. Of course, it was done at a much more crude level, but this was the same thing with the Athenian state many, many, many centuries before this. They fought for the republican system, so-called democratic system of one type or another. So they created this myth that the Florentines are the battlers for freedom in Italy, were battlers for truth and republican virtue, the defense of liberty, etc., etc. And the point of it, of course, is to justify these expenditure, to justify this debt, and just as importantly, remove any guilt for the siege of Pisa. Over time, especially when they start worrying about the finances, mercenaries ended up inflicting far more damage on the governments that hired them, the oligarchs that hired them, than on anybody else. Middle of the 15th century, massive levels of military spending. And this is on top of their tremendous debt that they had in the first place. It was totally unsustainable. The middle of the 15th century, interest payments alone were about 300,000 gold florins yearly. Again, a monstrous sum for such a tiny place. A few authors even note that the elite found these taxes absolutely beyond the pale. 36 separate taxes on one day, February of 1432. The levy was not just, was a third of the average citizens' wealth, not income, but wealth. Wealthy people are borrowing more money to pay taxes. And the only way that that was justified was for that handful of people, paying them and getting something in the medium term back. Then, of course, the war with Milan, which ended in 1430. A few unsuccessful wars after that. Taking Pisa threatened the Milanese. And now you have debt that's been collecting interest for now 60 years. There are wars against the papacy, etc. The Visconti Wars. And you know, this wasn't the way that it was functioning there. All the northern Italian city-states were pretty much in the same boat. Venice did the same thing. And whether it be taxation or devaluation, it didn't fix the problem. It exacerbated the problem. And the only time bond values were taken seriously is in a military victory. As these wars dragged on, and we're talking about Venice here, their paper ended up being something like 10% of its face value. I mentioned forced loans because they're paying, the elite are paying full value for a bond that over time, given the nature of this debt, given the nature of the war, consistently drops in value. The most they would ever hope would be something like 20% of the purchase price in a short time. Now, this is a chaotic picture here. And very much like the Polish ruling class, maybe around the same time, a little bit earlier, they made the disastrous and very dangerous decision to invite the Jews in the city. This was a new source of revenue, revenue of the last resort. They seemed to have Jews seem to have an unending supply of money. And in one form or another, it was I don't want to say, you know, it scams, but the use of manipulation. There was no genuine reform of the economic system. They knew that there was violence bubbling just below the surface. And when it comes from your own people, when it comes from your own elites, you have a problem. So the exploitation of labor came roughly at the same time as the currency was debased. People like Lorenzo Medici needed a psychological form of, not just the economic or financial, the psychological form of manipulation. And the other word for that is the Renaissance. But it needs to be kept in mind, the long-standing, you know, several centuries of North Italian dominance in finance and trade is coming to an end by 1400. The worst part is that in that part of the world, the dominance of the Italian banks, the Italian merchant classes, created this egocentric love of money. And now, because of the wars, because of the 100 years war, because there's so many other issues, there's less and less money to satisfy that. These financial instruments, and you could name a few that are going on today that were pioneered back then. The economy was dying. How many times do I use the phrase the dying regime? Dying societies that are, well, at least back then, very proud, dominant mentality. How they react to that, how they react to decline is an interesting psychological study. Beginning of the 15th century, and this, we could talk about contemporaries here. North Italy was not just in a state of economic decline, but moral and religious decline. You know, the Bishop of Florence, Antonio, says that this was no longer a Christian part of the world. Ego was dominant. Money was seen as a good in and of itself. Mafia tactics were being used, things like, you know, piracy and private violence. And this affected everybody. It affected the clergy, high and low. It affected the monastics. It affected the battles between the Guelph and the Ghibelline, who loathed each other, which was a big ideological cleft in Italy and a few other places. I want to quote, well, I'm not quoting him, but one of the great formulations that E. Michael Jones put out many years ago, and there's a few others who've done this too, the juxtaposition of this rapid moral decline with the rise of very arcane financial instruments, economic sophistication, was deadly. When society is already debased, you come up with more and more sophisticated ways of making money, interest from interest, no different than the derivative scam in the West. It's, of course, only short term, but there's no limit now on what you can do to labor, what you can do to the population as a whole. And don't think that the Reformation was independent of this. It was not independent of this. I mean, the Black Death alone would have caused a lot of this. Now you have many other issues. 30% of the population died during the plague. But even there, that's a problematic number because urban areas, which is what North Italy was, suffered far greater than rural areas. So, for example, between 1340 and 1350, almost 80% of the population of Florence died. You had a massive shortage of labor in the wool industry, but you couldn't have wages go too high. So, like any good capitalist, they bring in immigrants from elsewhere. But if, you know, at the very least, they were able to work for less. Given the nature of the debt higher wages was out of the question. It was a, and of course, the papacy of Avignon, where he ended up having three claimants to the papacy. This did tremendous damage, not just to the popes at the time, but to the papacy in general. And it ushered in the Council of Constance, the institutionalization of conciliar rule rather than papal rule. The concept of this centralized papacy fell on very hard times when you have three of them. It started in 1378, and this has a lot to do with the French position during the Hundred Years' War, because the French monarch had reneged on debt. So families like the Medici, which are in Florence and Rome, were a big problem. The Medicis were going to elect popes, and the French crown did something about it. The Avignon papacy, of course, associated with the French monarchy, and hence was a Ghibelline institution, so to speak. Avignon was a papal enclave, completely surrounded by what, you know, today is the French state. And that, you know, at least in propaganda, whether in propaganda or reality, had a tremendous reputation for corruption. This has everything to do, you know, the papacy sided with the Guelphs or the Federation of Independent City-States, and hence the Medici clan. But the Avignon papacy was to escape that influence. And there were several Avignon popes, the last being Gregory the 11th. And even when Gregory the 11th returned to Rome in 1377, he ended up going back. But before he was able to go, I mean, he decided to go back. He died beforehand, 1378. But the Medicis, among others, use violence to make sure that a pope from Rome would be elected, or at least loyal to it. And they were going to use by any means necessary to do that. There were 70 years in Avignon for some very good reasons. The Council of Pisa, prior to all of this, it didn't solve the issue. But the Pisan anti-pope John the 23rd, called the Council of Constance. It's ended in 1418. And that finally elected Pope Martin the V. And he reigned from Rome. But what all of this did, I mean, there was some good reason to leave. Banking, control, usury was one of the issues, especially in the context of the Hundred Years' War. And this is happening just prior to this general collapse of social morality, that the wars against Pisa and Milan did nothing to improve. And this is the context where they come up with every possible way of using interest to charge rents. As far as Western Christendom is concerned, really the only hope laid with the Dominicans and the Franciscans. But you had, you know, regular clergy, you know, the Anthony of Florence died in 1459, the Archbishop of Florence also was well aware of what was happening around him. But because you didn't have, it was very difficult to take on a family like the Medicis. I mean, Savonarola, I've spoken of him at great length on this show and many other places. They treated economics as simply another realm of moral philosophy, which in and of itself is not a problem, but it does have its own engines. Of course, they were consistently condemning avarice and usury, but it was very hard to speak to a population that didn't even understand how the bankers were functioning. This is tremendously complex commercial and financial life. All these, you know, titles of interest, all, you know, these things that bills of exchange, and of course they were involved in currency speculation at the time. It was very hard to tell the difference between a legitimate innovation and moral corruption and rent-seeking. Now, there were at least four general arguments against usury, both East and West. And it kind of went like this. The first argument was that usurer uses time to make a profit. It's almost the buying and selling of time, which is not possible. This is an extreme egocentric usurpation. The second one was the question of what is consumed by using it. The difference between the money and the thing that the money was used for. Money is kind of like cheese. It's consumed with its use. Therefore, once the thing is gone, whatever was accruing from that doesn't belong to you anymore. It no longer exists. Use and consumption were one and the same thing as far as money is concerned. It was a double charge, charging for the same thing twice. Not to mention the simple fact, finally, that money is sterile. It can't reproduce itself naturally. It has to be done unnaturally through oligarchy and these methods, these, you know, double entry bookkeeping or whatever it is. Things like derivatives, all manner of short and long game, whether it's stocks or bonds. It's even less comprehensible now than it was during the late Middle Ages. The battle here, and to put it more simply, is between labor, that is to say, productive, the creation of value, taking something and making it more useful for it, versus gambling. Usury is non-productive. Now, let me give you a counterexample. A long time ago, I did a paper on shukuk. This is a Islamic commercial device. It's not merely Islamic. So many of the Islamic powers refuse to charge riba or interest. Interest cannot be charged in Islamic law. The real issue, and this is clarifying what I just said, the bond or the debt itself has to be based on something real, the result of actual labor. Money isn't abstract in this case. What I kind of meant in, you know, summarizing the arguments against usury is the distinction between the money as an entity and what the money spent on. And the only thing that it should be spent on at the macro level is productive investment. Only labor working on an asset can create money. They refuse to separate money and value. What they mean by interest, and this is not just in Islam, although some naive writers don't really know. In fact, there was an excellent article in Anthropology Today some years ago by Bill Maurer, who very naively says that the concept of riba, or interest, is far more complex than how we use the term. Well, it was the exact same thing as you would have gotten hundreds of years earlier. He just doesn't know that. It's a moral doctrine. It's a moral doctrine that can be applied to economics. It's not inherently an economic concept. Interest in the Islamic sense, and the way I use the way I've always defined the term, usury, refers to rent seeking. Any value that accrues to the bondholder or any kind of, you know, asset that is independent of the value it generates in and of itself. Anything that does not, in other words, come from labor. Sukuk is a guarantee of that labor. And it's no different than how usury has been defined in the pay. Even the councils in the West defined it as far more than just taking interest, let alone excessive interest. That's much less the issue than charging a rent. And sukuk has been successful all over the Islamic world. And there's a full banking system based on this. Riba, just like usury, the way we should use the term, includes political manipulation. Any non-economic source of value accruing to the bondholder, or in this case, the oligarchs. Profit and power are about manipulating the very concept, the concept and context of investments. It's not a matter of the power of money, it's what money is able to do via labor. Money, investment decisions are as much moral as they are anything else. Labor has to be protected and valued. And therefore, when money is loaned to an enterprise, either during its existence or to found it, that automatically makes the lender a partner. The lender is then given its profit, his profit, via the profit of the enterprise. But if the enterprise goes belly up, so does that money. The money does not have an autonomous existence. And that's a crucial distinction between the Islamic and classical conceptions of interest versus the modern. Of course, like everything modern has been redefined and completely reduced to almost nothing in terms of definition. So money does not have an independent existence. People like Noonan, and I've come across the criticism of him in a few other places, he tries to argue that money is in fact fertile, because when money buys, let's say, a factory or a field for growing things, well, that means that money bears more money. And it's a terrible, terrible argument. And you hear this from time to time from people who really seem to have missed the point here. The only thing that makes a factory valuable is labor. You have to work at it. Value exists where money exists, and only where value exists. And value is created as the product of the application of human labor, both physical and mental. In fact, you know, a field, for example, is one of Noonan's examples in his book, the Scholastic Analysis of Usury. So it's supposed to be a sympathetic piece, a book. Uses terms like money to be value, but in fact, in the system he's defending, it's not the case. A field is only conceivable as any kind of a productive thing when someone works on it. That's not money itself. That's human labor. It can be represented in money. And it goes no further than that. Money is sterile. That same field bought by someone who does nothing with it is not producing any value. There may be money there, but there's no value there. That distinction is absolutely critical, absolutely crucial. But money is a talisman. It's able to blind people. It did at the time, and it does now. So, you know, money left, actual physical cash left by itself, is not going to do anything. Now, it's only when it is invested properly, rationally, does it then become productive of value, and hence wealth and income. Money is barren. Money can't reproduce itself, but it also, without any contradiction, it has almost a seminal quality because it's so invested. Human labor is what turns money into value and value into money. Production, not derivatives. Because if this system is even to be slightly, even for short term, maintained or maintainable or sustainable, there has to be a concomitant increase in production, which of course is not happening. Investment implies labor and hence value. Now, as a few authors, Jones and I don't remember if it's Hoffman or not, but if this is difficult for people to understand now, it was infinitely worse back then. So much of the Islamic idea of interest comes from the patristic tradition, at least indirectly. And of course, it's been successful. Usury is the opposite of labor. Usury, in the sense we're defining it as a market income, money, not necessarily value, but money and other things accruing to the bondholder from things that have nothing to do with the actual use of that lent money. But it's very easy for someone who does this every day to justify it, especially given the time period, especially when there's a lot of money at stake. If anything, the condemnation of usury at the time led to an anti-clerical reaction. This is really what humanism was in the West. It's not a dead issue, I could tell you that. The U.S. system is collapsing under its own debt. Usury is the issue. It's the opposite, not just the opposite of labor, but it's the opposite of economic development. Now, this is very different from the pawn shop financier or the payday loan. I've spoken of that on here before. You have something like 1,500% on some of these payday loans. That's a little different from, you know, local deposit banking or bills of exchange and currency exchanges. And that's kind of why, at least at the time, the Medici got away with certain things. They weren't pawnbrokers. That became, at least at this point, the domain of the Jews. There were no Jewish moneylenders in Florence in the late 14th century, but there were just a couple of generations later. Now, you started off talking about the debt, the wars, the slow removal of power from North Italy to elsewhere. As the Middle Ages came to a close, talked about overweening taxation and bankruptcy, and yet a few families thrived. We're talking now then about the manifestation of mass poverty. This is now where pawnbroking becomes a force in its own right. Jews were brought in to make up that revenue shortfall, and they worked out a deal with the local prince, the local podesta, the local the signor that we mentioned early on, as to what the ceiling may be. And of course, the poor had to put up articles for collateral. So by definition, you're in financial distress. They had to pawn something of value, and they didn't have much of value. And if it was something that they needed to function, that guaranteed that debt would be eternal. And he'll end up paying back many, many times the initial principal. Regardless of your conception of usury, this was the heart of it, at least in the popular consciousness. It cannot be dismissed in this sense, because the increasingly large pool of poor people were suffering tremendously from the monopoly of these rent seekers and usurers. But that is not the full definition of usury. To be honest, attacks on the Jews, especially the burning down of their bank buildings, was a way of destroying that paper and hence destroying the debt. People like Parks, who I cited earlier, this kind of violence was a way to get out of it. You see it in England, the end of the 12th century. they at least destroyed the financial records, or worse. This wasn't irrational anti-Jewish feeling. This was a response to debt that could never end. In England, by the middle point of the Middle Ages, you had riots in Worcester, Northampton, Canterbury, with all the records destroyed. And the minute the Jews were readmitted, for example, they were readmitted to France in 1360, they had a period of peace before then. The rate that they negotiated was 87% on distress loans within 2 years, or less than that, this same sort of violence began. And this is where the either special protections or the badges that they had to wear, and they didn't have their own special courts anymore because of the nature of this abuse. There was a desperation to maintain social order, but that made that almost completely impossible. Jewish money lending and social violence was paralleled throughout this period of time. Wherever one existed, you saw the other. The Council of Trier, Germany in 1228, usurers. Again, this, and I'm quoting this because it goes to show exactly what usury really is and how it was considered at the time. Usurers were lumped together with, and I'm quoting here directly, witches, incendiaries, evildoers, highway robbers. They used terms like fornicators, keepers of concubines, adulterers. In Trier, the sin of usury was classed with homicide, sacrilege, perjury, homosexuality, parricide. And in fact, were so severe, they couldn't in and of themselves. They're not, you can't cleanse yourself with confession. This is one of the sins that cries out to heaven for vengeance. And yet, as true as all of that is, it doesn't get to the heart of the matter. If increasing commercial activity is leading, of course, as it has to an increasing demand for money, and the money supply is inherently limited, especially when you debase the coinage, the coinage that's used to pay wages. Well, you can condemn it all you want. The only option for most people then was some kind of loan. At the time, people conflated money and value, or money and gold. Having gold means to be wealthy. Ignoring, hence, the most important part, which was labor. Increasing the supply of money is one of the reasons that they went to the Jews. And as E. Michael Jones says in Barren Metal, they also engaged in, the Jews engaged in their own propaganda. Mayor Ben Simeon of Southern France said that our loan sharking is a benefit to society, because this is the only way that the poor can have what they need, despite the fact that they lose everything they have as a result. But even elites said, well, if these Jews stop lending, you're going to have actual starvation. 1311, I mean, this is before even the era that we're talking about. Council of Milan, or Bergamo, reaffirmed all the old canons. You couldn't even get Christian burial if you were involved in usury. The upshot of it all is that as commercial activity increases and spreads out over a larger and larger area, and this goes hand in hand with urbanization, you get drawn into a monetized economy, but with less and less money available. But, of course, you know, the concept of wages was brand new. In Europe, the idea of a wage was almost impossible to conceive. Certainly when it came to abusers at the payday loan types, there was no question about it. But wages weren't even considered, even though you had strong guilds in places like Florence. But even in the 18th century, you know, 90% of the population of France was engaged in agriculture. It really wasn't until this era that you have some initial interest in a just wage. Especially when you consider that early on people realized it is such an unequal bargain between someone who needs to be hired to make money and the person who's doing the hiring. But the consequences of usury, it's not nearly as obvious. No one talks about the massive level of their debt and that they may lose everything. I mean, this is how the mafia functions. You know, 50 years ago in America, usually taking advantage of a gambling debt. People can't control themselves, are addicted to this kind of thing. The Medici were able to get away with some of this because they used things like currency exchanges as an excuse. They simply, that commission they considered was a hidden interest, so to speak. But to focus on the concept of interest being charged on a loan, that's way too narrow of a definition. I quoted these councils because it's far deeper than that. It's rent seeking. It's taking profit from the money itself, not what the money is invested to create. And in the case of a payday loan, it's not invested in anything. The concept being that you eventually get paid and you could cover at least some of the principal, which doesn't happen all the time. Now, a loan shark will break your legs if you don't pay quickly enough. He can't kill you, for obvious reasons. But he could hurt you or threaten you with it. Banks, of course, don't have to do that. They have other ways of torturing you. Just prices, just wages, and even just war were similar questions. Now, the point here is that the Medici were not involved in payday loans. At least not directly. This was a high-end level of transaction. You know, something like a bill of exchange, which has to do with, for example, a long overland route. Kind of a disguised profit that has nothing to do with what the money is being spent on, investment-wise. And for the most part, the church saw something like that as necessary. Or the need to exchange currencies. You know, there was a use there, whether it be, you know, an insurance for, you know, long overland route for goods or exchanging currencies. These are useful functions because trade is almost impossible without it. And you can't actually ship gold from one place to another. So a bill of exchange makes sense, as well as giving a certain peace of mind. That's a useful concept. It doesn't matter if it's a loan or not. What matters is that it's something that can be rationally just. But these are very brief exceptions. These are exceptions that come with the nature of geography. But even that has to be connected with what this is being invested in. Of course, the payday loan idea is completely unsustainable. The bills of exchange ended up being a disguised interest payment because you're negotiating, accounts payable in different places with different customs and usually different currencies. The bill of exchange is the price of the bill itself. And so it wasn't a loan, and it was useful. It has to do with proper, not speculative, investment. You can't have speculation when the only thing that matters is the value created by labor and everything that goes along with that. It's a mistake to say that they were finding ways around usury laws. Because usury is a rent extracting value, extracting money, or even political power from holding a bond or holding a stock. That's not inherent to the bond or the stock itself. And even a bond is tightly connected to stocks in this scheme, because it exists only because of productive investment. But derivatives are, the money isn't there to begin with. In a derivative, any of these swaps, the underlying commodity, if it exists at all, is not even owned by the person who's extending the money and profiting from it. I've gone way over my allotted time, and I know that this is not the easiest thing to deal with, but it is a core concept in the destruction of the Middle Ages and the beginning of the Machiavellian and Hobbesian Renaissance and early modern period. And the distinction at its root is economic. It's financial. And in fact, comes from the decay of the northern Italian states functioning as plutocracies, pretending to be something else, and how they rationalized it. The interest payments, the debt, the wars that had to be fought, the fact that their economies were connected to warfare in the sense that their bond price wouldn't fall as much, that somehow all this needed to be justified. And this ideological propaganda that you saw as far back as the Athens-Sparta War, all the way up to modern, equally as simple and vulgar propaganda today. None of this is in the interests of labor. And labor is, in fact, the only thing that can create value. So in redefining what, we mentioned the Islamic riba, that's a proper definition of usury. It's not merely a matter of loans. It's the fact that people are getting wealthy on non-productive things, things that don't derive from the investments where this loan was raised to create in the first place. Money seems to have power in and of itself. Gold seems to have power in and of itself. And of course, that's not the case. When you redefine it that way, things become a little simpler. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.